Uhuru, and welcome to Solidarity Not Charity, the weekly program of the African People's Solidarity Committee here on uhururadio.com. As always, we want to thank the African People's Socialist Party for giving us this time on uhururadio.com and, frankly, for giving us the ability to look at the world and be a part of the world as it is understood and experienced through the eyes and experience of African and other colonized peoples struggling to be free the world over. The African People's Solidarity Committee organizes in the white community to build solidarity, reparations, support, unity from the white community with the African Liberation Movement under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party. That program, that song that you just heard was called Colonial Mentality by Fela Kuti. And that's exactly what we're trying to help other white people like ourselves to break away from, that colonial mentality and that colonial reality where we don't want to be a part of imperialist, colonialist state and society resting on the pedestal of the stolen resources and labor and lives of African and other colonized people. So we want to welcome you to the program today. On today, and by the way, what a great day. Wow, what a great day of programming it's been here on uhururadio.com. Throughout the day, I hope that you've had a chance to tune in. The program that airs at 11 o'clock U.S. Eastern Time each Sunday now is just really dynamic with the crisis of the U.S. economy and the development of the new Barack Obama regime cabinet forming and beginning to see some of the reality of what the next administration is going to be doing and is going to be like. It's been really informative to learn about that on that program, and that's going to be ongoing, sort of a town hall style from 11 to 12 U.S. Eastern Time, so I hope you have a chance to tune into that. And then at 1 today, phenomenal program, which if you didn't hear, I would definitely recommend you tune into the archives, go to the archives for the Uhuru on the Move program that'll be up later this week. Chioma Oru, who was on that program talking about AFRICOM and the development of AFRICOM, which just became official last month and is the development of a very treacherous strategy on behalf of the U.S. for spreading its tentacles even deeper into the continent of Africa to facilitate stealing the resources, the tremendous natural wealth of Africa. And it was a very informative program at 1 o'clock on Uhuru on the Move. And then the program that just precedes ours, The Colonialism is Bad for Your Health with Iyapo Ngina. If you have any questions about vaccines for your children, it was very informative show that she did on that. So it's been a great broadcast day. And, of course, Amalia Chatella Speaks, that we want to always encourage our listeners, if you have not already, to subscribe to Uhuru Radio so that you can go back and listen to all of the fantastic speeches by African People's Socialist Party Chairman Amalia Chatella that are broadcast each morning or near the beginning of the broadcast at 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern, with historical and current speeches by African People's Socialist Party Chairman Amalia Chatella. If you miss it, the only way you can get to it is by becoming a subscriber of uhururadio.com. So for a minimum of $10 a month, you can get unlimited access to phenomenal speeches by the chairman, and really encourage you to do that. And if you didn't know, if you haven't tuned in yet since it started, there's a new program on uhururadio.com that kicks off the day. It's at 8 a.m. U.S. Eastern, which is broadcast, it's called Uhuru Time, and it's broadcast directly from Azania, from South Africa, from Cliptown, I believe. And it is hosted by Sailo Tlada, who is a fantastic organizer in Azania, and you get the update of what's going on in Azania, where currently there's tremendous political crisis and upheaval as a part of the whole crisis of U.S. imperialism worldwide. And you get the news direct from the source at 8 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time on uhururadio.com. So today on Solidarity Not Charity program, We're going to broadcast, we're going to share with you a speech that you probably have not heard before that was presented by Chairwoman Penny Hess of the African People's Solidarity Committee at a teach-in that took place at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia on February 24th in 1990. Really good presentation. We thought it would be informative and helpful. And as all of her presentations and our philosophy in the African People's Solidarity Committee, we always want to recognize where the theory and the understanding and the information and the analysis comes from, and it comes from the African People's Socialist Party, and it's our attempt to adopt that worldview, express it, and win other white people to see the world from the eyes of the African working class and the African liberation movement. At the beginning of this tape, we're actually going to share with you the recording that begins from a point at which Chairwoman Hess was responding to a woman in the audience at this teach-in who had raised a demand that of certain issues that were significant to the white community, and as a condition for supporting the African liberation movement, she was demanding to know whether the African liberation movement was going to support these white issues. And there was some ideological struggle that ensued off of her demand. And so just letting you know that what you're going to be hearing is sort of Chairwoman Hess's wrapping up of that dialogue and then going into her presentation. So let's hear now from African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia on February 24th, 1990.
We're talking about a meeting today that could enable us for the first time to see the world through the eyes of African people, which is the same view of the majority of human beings on this planet. Why is it that, you know, that every place, you know, you read about it in the newspaper that people all over the world are hijacking planes and taking as hostages just regular North American people, just regular white people, when, you know, not even some dignitary from the government or something like that? Because in the United States, the general population of white people, and the same with Europeans, identifies with the United States government even if we're working class. Even if we're working class, we're upholding what our government, our bourgeoisie, our own bosses do, even if we don't have everything, because we want to keep our place in the world. And it's not just that somehow everybody in the world hates us for no reason. Like, you know, we're paranoid. Why is it everybody hates us? Because of what the United States represents all around the world, and that is true here. And this is a movement, this is a meeting that can begin to transform that for the first time. And then we can begin to see some North American people for the first time in history to end our blind, stupid, idiotic allegiance with our own oppressors and begin to stand with the masses of humanity. That's what this is about. And it means challenging everything that we have ever thought, all assumptions that we have grown up with. Because everything that we do, that we think, every way that we live, is tainted by the ideology of white power, which is the ideology of imperialism and colonialism. And so it's like, this is the thing that I'm Penny Hess, and I'm a member of the African People's Solidarity Committee. We work under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party. We work in the white communities to not just to build support for the movement for black power, but to erode the alliance of the North American population with U.S. imperialism and begin to do just what we said, recognize that our real allies in the world are African people. And it's not just a matter of conscience, although it is that too. We can say that it's a matter of survival, because African people in this country and all of the colonized peoples around the world are in a process of tearing down brick by brick this system that has existed for the last 500 years of terrorizing most of the people on the planet Earth, and that if we're going to, if we want to, you know, not go down with that, we better recognize where humanity is staying. The thing is that the ideology of imperialism is white supremacy. It is white power. It teaches us all the myths that we readily buy because it has paid us off. It has bought us off to be the richest general population, working population in the world. We take the assumption then that somehow we got this because we deserved it or because our fathers came over here from Ireland or Italy or wherever and worked really hard. And within one generation, they moved out of the Lower East Side into the suburbs, blah, 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 got a good job, and now I can go to Penn and I can go to Wharton or whatever, you know, because we are naturally superior. That's what we're taught to believe. And the generally North American people buy that. Well, yeah, okay, I guess I am, you know. That's what you told me, I guess I am. And that we were thrifty, our family was thrifty, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing that if we want to come to the truth, if we want to come to the truth, which is what we want to do today, then we have to tear away all those myths, which are absolutely absurd, and look at the reality, which is brutal, which is extremely painful to look at, because we're talking about the fact that we live in a system that has benefited us, but it is a system based on terror, genocide, slavery, thievery, and murder, killing. I mean, it's unbelievable. If we could go through the whole history, we might spend 2 or 3 weeks sitting here documenting what U.S. imperialism and Western imperialism has done to build itself. It is a brutal, it is a vicious history. But we have to look at it straight in the face because it says something about who we are and why we are in the position that we're in today. We're talking about counterinsurgency today, which is a war, a military and political tactics to put down a rebellion. And that's something old. That's not something new. They've always used counterinsurgency. This system has always used counterinsurgency. And why would people be in rebellion? People are rebelling because one population, one sector of human beings are oppressing and taking everything that another sector has and taking it for themselves. And if we go back and look at how this system was founded, you know, we can look at the fact that we're taught European values. We're taught that Europe is the greatest civilization on the face of the earth, and if you went to college, if you go to college, you're supposed to read European literature. You're supposed to like the art, or at least study the art of Europe. You're supposed to at least one summer save your money and go to Europe, look around at the great cathedrals, and generally be imbued with respect and awe for this, which is supposed to have been the greatest civilization on the face of the earth. But in fact, when we look at the history and we go back to the Middle Ages, we look at the fact that in Europe it was a cold, barren land. They didn't have a lot of food. They didn't have a lot of resources. They didn't have spices or coffee or tea or even rice. They didn't have bananas, oranges, gold, silver. They didn't have beautiful cloth and fabric. They didn't have beautiful porcelain. They didn't have anything. They just had, you know, like they just ate things like pickled herrings and sauerkraut and, you know, like really, really gross kind of food. And it was like people wore horns. And, I mean, you know, the men wore horns on their head and animal cloths and stuff. And they kept, you know, it was a patriarchal society, and they kept women chained, or they had to wear chains around them so that they wouldn't, you know, like while this guy was out looting and raiding and stuff, that, you know, his wife wouldn't start to like another guy that wore horns on his head and stuff like this, you know. They killed babies if they were deformed in any way. They just left them out in the cold to die. They had a very alienated, patriarchal kind of society. But in Africa and other places, it was completely different. They had food just growing on the trees, and they had spices, they had gold and silver, which they didn't worship, they just used to make life more beautiful. Women had political and economic power. children were all taken in. No child was abandoned because its foot was crooked or its leg wasn't straight. The society was broad and vast, and it was nurturing, and it was hospitable. And they didn't go around looting other people. Yes, they visited South America in ancient times. If you look at a map, the west coast of Africa is only a few hundred miles from the east coast of Brazil. And so it's obvious that the peoples visited each other and traded with each other. And in the continent of what's now called America, North and South America, there were highly developed civilizations. There were people who the Aztecs, the Incas, as we say it in English, who traded with each other, who had beautiful buildings that they tell us today could only have happened because spaceships came and did that or something like that. They can't admit that in ancient societies before Europe, there were things greater than ever existed in Europe. In Africa as well, there were great universities where Europeans went. And in fact, Greece and Rome, what's called the wisdom of the ancient society in Europe, in fact, came from Africa, from African societies. And what happened was, they tell you that in the Middle Ages, Europeans went out on the Crusades to seek... I went to Catholic school, so we were told that it was to, seek the Holy Grail, which I think is the part of the cross or something like this. And suddenly, it would be totally bizarre. All of these people all over Europe were galloping off to... Monty Python is what you think of, galloping off somewhere to look for the cross, which is, of course, ridiculous. They were going out looting. They were finding the spices. They were finding the gold. They were finding anything that they could and bringing it back into Europe, which was the basis of a mercantile capitalist society that was developing. And they decide, as the society transformed from feudalism and the beginning into capitalism, they needed ships, they needed gunpowder, which actually they got from the Chinese, who used it for firecrackers, for fun, for entertainment, but the Europeans used it for guns to kill people. It was Europe that introduced violence onto this planet. And so that's what we always have to raise up when we have our good white people that raise, well, what about the violence? What about the violence? The violence was introduced into the world by Europe. And with the strength of guns and gunpowder and cannons, they went into Africa and they looted, and they went into the Western Hemisphere, into the Americas, and so-called discovered America, and began a system of slavery and genocide onto human beings who had never known conquerors in that way, who welcomed the Europeans to their society with open arms, not knowing what they would do. And the Europeans would come in and say, well, who owns this land? And they would say, well, nobody owns the land. This belongs to everybody. And they would say, good, it's ours now. We're writing it up. And they started to define the land and make maps and say that they owned it. And when they came to this hemisphere and what's now called the Caribbean Islands, the United States, and South America, they began immediately to commit genocide. It says in some of the books that Columbus, when he first came over, was responsible immediately for killing thousands of native indigenous people here just by breathing on them, because they had never been exposed to all the dreadful diseases that existed in Europe. And so thousands died just in the contact that way, but most people died in a much more brutal way than that. They began the slave trade, and they went in and they forced African people either to die or to come into slavery. They had no choice, through the force of the gun, through economic coercion as well, and began what was a 400-year economic system that created so much wealth that we can't even today fathom what it means for all of this free labor and for the trade that ensued to have gone into the economy that benefited and went to the wealth of Europe and then North America. They came to this hemisphere and they found gold. And, as you were saying yesterday, that it had never occurred to the indigenous people here who use gold and silver to worship gold. And there was a thing that was in one of the books that we were reading that was a quotation from something that I think the Aztecs wrote in the 16th century that said that the white man must eat gold. It said they hunger and thirst after gold like hungry swine, that they would kill for gold. Well, they couldn't imagine this. You know, they would say, where are the gold mines? They're right there, you know, and then they instantly would go in. And what they did was, through the slave trade and through the genocide of the native people, they mined the gold until it was gone, and they mined the silver until it was gone, and they used the native people and Africans and worked them to death. And we're talking about, there were places in South America where in the year 1515, where in parts of Europe where still mostly people lived in caves, and it was called the so-called, quote, Dark Ages of Europe, there were more people in some of the Andes Mountains at a height of 16,000 feet. There were more Europeans living there than there were in London in 1515 because of the wealth of the gold that was being extracted. That they would have these towns, like in Bolivia, in the mountains, where 250,000 Europeans would live just taking the wealth, just taking the wealth. They lived where, in the Middle Ages, there were great theaters encrusted with gold and diamonds, where there were mansions and restaurants and every kind of thing. Brothels, every kind of thing that there was. And they were, at the same time that Europeans were extracting this wealth, they were sending into the mines Africans and indigenous people and killing them at the rate of 4,000 a month. That meant every day, 24 hours a day, that people, the slaves and the native people, were being worked to death in freezing cold in the mines. They mined the silver with mercury, so they couldn't even live very long at all through mercury poisoning. They were sent naked into the mines with freezing cold in water up to their knees. They could only survive a few days at a time. The native people began, the women began to kill their babies rather than let them live a life and grow up like that. And this was the basis of the wealth that sent so much money into Europe that it was unbelievable, and it created the transformation into capitalism and an industrial society. The transformation continued as the slave trade continued and came into the United States as well. It created not just a few wealthy plantation owners as we're taught in our schools, because that was only, even the so-called slave trade that existed inside the United States was only a tiny little part of what the entire thing was. All throughout Brazil, the Caribbean, they wiped out, they exterminated whole populations. We're talking about 200 or 300 million people lived in this hemisphere are gone. They do not exist. So that if we have to look at the great cathedrals, the art, and the music and of Europe, we're talking about things that exist on a foundation of bones and blood and the civilizations of human beings who existed before it. We have to say that it's the ultimate of parasitic society, that there isn't something that Europeans created. Everything was stolen. The ability to have a so-called civilization was stolen. It's at the expense of everybody else. And if we are going to be honest and look at history in a truthful way, as the books are written outside of the United States, then we have to look at this reality. We have to say that there is nothing about Europe that is redeemable because it is off the backs of so many millions of human beings. When they went into Africa, they had Europeans went in the Middle Ages to the great universities at Mali, at Timbuktu, at other places in Central Africa, where people, there was no famine in Central Africa at that time. People grew the crops that they needed. But they came in, took all of the science and the knowledge, and wiped out and devastated the people and the culture, forcing only those crops or whatever natural resources to be mined that imperialism determined, so that before, where a people could grow everything they needed, create, make their own clothing, and live in their own society, now they must only grow sugar, if that's what U.S. imperialism said or Western imperialism said, which ruins the land and makes it dependent so that they can't even grow the things anymore. That what was once part of the great African sub-Saharan civilization is now dust, famine, and poverty, and starvation. Not because Africans didn't know how to manage their land. They were the greatest farmers and agricultural geniuses that existed in the world. But what happened was the devastation created by U.S. and Western imperialism. So that we have a situation in Africa today that where we see all the babies that are dying in starvation, and they think that the problem is going to be solved by having some bands have a big concert to help them. Of course, none of that money ever goes there, but is beside the point. They are there because the food can come here to this country to feed the children. Africa has the greatest oil reserves in the world, and it has the third largest water reserves in the world. But they cannot use their own reserves. They cannot put their oil to mechanize the farming for irrigation for the sub-Saharan region, which could be a great food producing, one of the greatest bread baskets that exists in the world. And this cannot happen because Africans do not control their own resources. All of it goes out. And the same is true of the Caribbean, of South America, and Central America. They can never control their own resources. Everything is determined. This is when we talk about the drugs, and the chairman has said the drugs are part of imperialism and the development of imperialism, and it has been used for a long time. For people in Colombia, it doesn't matter that much if it's drugs, if it's cocaine, or coffee. As much fighting and war and struggle between the coffee producers and the peasants have taken place over coffee as they have over drugs in Colombia right now. The fact is what the United States determines is going to be the crop or the resource is the only thing that can be produced in that country is what will happen. As the slave trade went on, it devastated Africa and it killed hundreds of millions of people and forced others out of their land, out of their own homeland, out of control of their own resources, their own culture, and into many other places in this hemisphere. It forced people into the most brutal form of existence that has ever existed on the face of the earth. And it was the wealth of the slave trade that built the banking industry, the shipping, the insurance, the brokerage firms, the stock markets, because the original stock was human beings. And it created the wealth of New York and of Liverpool and London, not just Charlotte, South Carolina, or North Carolina, whatever it is. It created the wealth of the northern industrial capital. And it when the struggle came down in the Civil War, it wasn't because some white people suddenly decided that it was immoral now, after 400 years, to have African people in bondage. It was because African people were struggling fiercely and threatening the plantation system themselves, not only inside the United States, but in the Caribbean and other places in South America. But also, the industrial infrastructure was growing up, which was becoming much more profitable than a plantation system, which is a system of the colonies. And the United States was forging into an industrial power equal with England, and it was attempting to do that. The fact is that counterinsurgency and violence and genocide has always accompanied United States and Western imperialism's attempts or actual fact of going into another country and controlling it and controlling its economy. So that it was the slave trade and the genocide that created a world economy that Chairman O'Malley talks about, which ties the entire world together under the capitalist system that exists today. So that so much wealth was accumulated that they could buy off, for the first time in history, the working classes. People came to the United States from Europe, from England, places where they had worked in the mines and there had been child labor, et cetera, et cetera. And here they were offered jobs as foremen over the slaves, or they were offered jobs in the factories where African people could not go. They were given land to, quote, settle the West by participating in killing the native people. And we hear about scalping, and they try to turn everything around, like they say Indian giver, when really they should say white person giver, because it means taking something back. And the native people never took anything back. They had everything taken away from them, and they talk about scalping. It wasn't the native people that did that except as retaliation, because it was white people who scalped. And I'm not just talking about Custer and the cavalry of the United States. I'm talking about regular people, our ancestors, who settled the West, were given land. They were given so many acres, they could, you know, they just have to homestead it. And they were paid $25 a scalp for every native person scalp that they could bring in to the cavalry, to the United States Army. That the United States regular people, working class white people, went out, participated in lynching, created lynching. What the United States government didn't do, white people got right in there and did it. The first county fairs in the South were because white people were lynching. They didn't just go out and kill somebody. They had whole picnics and everything all around it. It was, right. And when they went out into the West to settle and they killed, participated in genocide against the native people, they would steal native people's babies and make them their slaves. They did brutalities against the native people. Regular white people I'm talking about. This is white society. This isn't not that long ago. It's not even 100 years ago. They would stab the native people. They mutilated native women and took out their uteruses, and they would wear them as hats. That's what I'm talking about. This is the history of white society. This is the history. If you want to read Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. And that's, you know, this is the kind of thing that existed. This is genocide. Well, we're talking about why is it that white people, that North Americans, see the world in a certain way through the eyes of this government? This is why. This is why. This is why it's been, you know, paid off to do that. That we have a situation where even what passes as the left in this society, in this country, is it also has the same mentality as the U.S. government, wants to uphold the system that exists today. Let's make things better for white people, for white workers, but keep the system of colonialism intact. That's what we were just struggling about before, because we can't even say, if we're honest, that we're progressive unless we're going to talk about ending a system that rests on a pedestal of the exploitation of African people. We say, how is it that we live in a system where even the 10% or maybe 11% of the white population that's relatively poor will enthusiastically uphold U.S. imperialism,
right,
would join the Klan,
right,
will say, send the Klan to Iran,
right,
who will demonstrate in support of whatever the U.S. does around the world, who would fight against Vietnamese enthusiastically,
right,
rather than fight against the people who make money off of us. Why is that? Why could that be so? Racism? But racism doesn't mean anything. It's the ideas in people's heads. It's the material conditions of the society which even enabled white working class people to unite with the United States government, because it is a system of white power, and it says, if we didn't get what is due us yet, we're going to get it, and we're struggling for it because we're supposed to get it because we're white. And the idea is, if I didn't get it, my children are going to get it. And that's why I'm fighting for this government. That's why I'm fighting to uphold it. Otherwise, white people, white working class people, would be out there joining the Vietnamese, joining African people to tear down this system and tear down this government. But no, we're talking about a working class, the only working class in the world that can have a house, two cars, a boat, you know, and expect to send their kids to college. That's off the backs of other people. So we don't talk about that there's also poor white people. Yes, there are a few poor white people, but it is in the context of an oppressor nation. It is in the context of the pedestal of U.S. imperialism that is still based on colonial oppression. We're talking about the fact that there is no neutrality. There is no innocence for North American people. We can't say, well, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I just live here today, and I see that conditions are really bad. I see that, yes, if you really tell me, of course I didn't know it because I only lived my whole life behind a computer or otherwise going to the shopping mall or else looking at TV. But if you insist, this is when we do tables, I guess I did know that, yes, a million people are in prison and they're mostly African. And yes, I did see the article that said that almost 10 million people are arrested every year in this country and held for at least 3 days, and they're mostly African. But I don't have anything to do with it because I'm white and I'm just living in my suburb and I'm just trying to, you know, keep my life together and not deal with anything else. But what we're talking about today is that we're saying, no, South Africa is right here. You see how well you can see it if it's in South Africa? You can say, well, of course, no white person is innocent. They're part of the oppressor nation. But it is true here. It's just that we have the ability to see the injustices every place else, not because we want to end the colonial system, just because we don't want to be uncomfortable about doing what we continue to do to lead our lives. There isn't any way. We can't even, you know, grow our hair long, leave our jobs, and go out to some commune in the woods. We cannot do that. There is no escape because we have a heritage, and it is the heritage of the slave master, and we are responsible for what we do and for the stand that we take today. We're born into a time when it is the end, when the end of imperialism is near. Even though all the white people in Europe and Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union are banding together to try to get a little bit of the last gasp of the dying system, the fact is, in this country, in Africa, in Latin America, and in Asia, the masses of the people are rising up, are organizing, and are very, very clear about who their enemy is, and it will be destroyed. When we talk about the white left in this country, we have to go back and look at the fact that in the 1840s, in the 1850s, around in there in Europe, is when Karl Marx first started writing the Communist Manifesto and saying workers of the world unite. And all over Europe, there were a lot of near-revolutionary struggles. There was a lot of rebellion and workers' rebellion. And leftists, Marxists, communists came to this country. Some of them knew Karl Marx personally. And when they came to this country and they encountered the system of slavery, they didn't fight for the liberation of African people. They said, keep slavery so we can keep our jobs. Yeah. That was the white left in this country, which the Communist Party still continues to struggle in just exactly that same way. Around the middle of the 19th century in this country, we saw the beginning of the women's movement. And it was fighting for the right to vote. But they said they were politicized by many Africans who were struggling against the system of slavery, struggling for freedom and independence. But when it came down to the question of whether Africans would be able to vote, the white women's movement said, no way. They would not support Africans to have the vote. And they betrayed the African movement. They said, white people only. And that we're supposed to revere Susan B. Anthony and people like this who wrote that. I think Susan B. Anthony said, if men must dominate us, then let them be of the noble white race. They cannot be of the African race. Right. Yes, yes. This is the history of the women's movement, because we're saying that unless we deal with the pedestal, unless we deal with the ultimate question at the bottom of this, we're talking about white rights. So why is it that you go all the way up to the 30s when there was, again, rebellion in this country of, quote, white workers, and all of a sudden, you know, the factory workers could get $15, $20 an hour, 3 weeks paid vacation, etc. And this was the movement, not to end imperialism, but to give white working class a greater percentage of the loot stolen from the peoples of the world so that the resources could be here. At the same time, in the same period, there was the movement of Marcus Garvey, who was a black power, who led a black power movement that existed in this country, in Africa, in the Caribbean, and in South America. There were millions of African people who belonged to that. And the white left, in the form of the Communist Party, cooperated with the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover, who got his start at that time, in devastating and crushing down that movement in much the same way that the Panthers were later crushed down in the 60s. But when we look at the fact that, as the chairman has said, that it is white power that is responsible for the problems that North Americans have as well, that we can't, you know, we have to say, okay, we think that we live in the greatest civilization in the world, and yet, you know, I live out in Oakland and out over in Berkeley. They have whole magazines that are published about, you know, every month. You know, thick. I'm talking about big magazines on all the support groups and different kinds of therapy that you can go to, you know, to get help. And it makes us, like, look in and see what is the problem. I saw in some newspaper, I think it was the National Enquirer, which is, you know, really good to read while you're waiting in the grocery line, that 6,000 people a year in the United States are killed by serial murderers, which is a high percentage of, you know, it's a telling thing of a very alienated society, because serial murderers are white. You know, you look at, well, what is the society that creates a Ted Bundy that he was, they know for sure he killed 33 women, but they think that he killed about 150 women, this guy. He just went around from town to town, brutally killing women. You know, here are how many people in this country who are on trial now for sexually abusing children in child care centers? You know, you just look at all of the erosion of white society, the alcoholism, the drug addiction, and it's true, you and I know, if we're honest, the drugs are a tremendously common part of white society, but there it's not the martial law that exists. But what is the problem inside of North American society is a violence and terror and exploitation and genocide that this government that we unite with carries out around the world, turned in onto our own society. And that's what happened in Nazi Germany as well. Because you saw for the first time white people killing other white people in order to perfect the white supremacy ideology. And it created, a lot of people paid attention to that, because for the first time it was white people. They didn't say anything about the millions and millions of Africans and indigenous people who had already been killed brutally, even more brutally, by the same system and by the same government. So we know that we recognize, yes, there are problems inside of the North American society, but we recognize that the source is living in a colonial system that we live in and participating in it. So therefore, there is no way that we can talk about women's rights without talking about tearing down the system that has brutalized human beings around the world. That anything else is just talking about building up white women to get the same power in the system that white men have. And that is not what we're fighting for. We're saying that the system must end. You can see, like, we say that North Americans participate in the counterinsurgency that exists today, and it's not, it cannot be neutral. When we're talking about between $100 billion and $600 billion coming into the society, into the economy, off of the drug trade, we know that that doesn't go into the African community. It benefits white society. Why is it that Bank of America could make a profit last year of almost more than $10 billion after having a deficit of just about that much 3 years ago, only because it began to launder the money, the drug money, in a greater way. That's the only way it could have happened. That's how, I think it was one of the frontline series that was on public broadcasting system said that the money is laundered through Dean Witter, Bank of America, you know, named all the corporations. These are the major money laundering corporations inside the United States. And it's true. That's why you can start out in your beginning job there at $60,000 or $70,000 a year, because of the infusion of wealth into this economy off of the drug trade. If we look at the participation of North Americans in the counterinsurgency, to me the most blatant example is what just happened in Boston with Charles Stewart, because here is sort of the ultimate alienation and sickness of the white society, where this guy, with the participation of his brothers and sisters, killed his wife, who was 8 months pregnant, so that he could get the insurance money, and he knew that he would never get caught because all he had to say was an African person did it. And the only reason that he got caught was because his brother finally said, was forced to say something about it. And everybody knew this. All their friends knew it. A whole lot of people knew about it. It's just taken for granted. Well, okay, we're not going to tell Mom. You know, they have this conversation between the brother and sister. Don't tell Mom what he did. You know, like the guy killed his wife and his baby. I mean, it's, you know, we say we glorify the civilization and the society. No. You know, we say we recognize, you know, that there are serious problems, but it comes from colonialism. It cannot be perfected. There is no way out besides joining a revolutionary movement that is led by African people. And we recognize that this movement, this meeting that we're talking about, gives us an opportunity for the first time in history to have an analysis that will tell us something about the reality of the world and take us out of denial and fantasy and self-aggrandizement and illusion, and put us into reality and say that it's an opportunity for us as North American people, for the first time in history, and this is a very, very historic relationship that we have with this movement today, because it gives us an opportunity to break with all the opportunism, the filth, the terror, and the brutality of our relationship with this government, and join humanity for the first time to be able to be part of a movement that is about the destruction of this system and the beginning of a world with the only way that there can be peace and justice in the world. I hope that people can find out more about the African People Solidarity Committee and the Uhuru Solidarity Committee, that we exist here in Philadelphia. We're active. We distinguish ourselves from other kinds of left and liberal groups off the basis of what we have just put out today. We base our work in reparations. We say we recognize that 75% of the world's resources are controlled by the white population of Europe and North America, and we take up our responsibility to raise funds to recognize that the resources will be controlled by the people whose they are genuinely, and that we want to aid and abet that process. And I hope that people can go to the literature table, talk to Sandy, Diane, Ruby, other people who are here from the Solidarity Committee, and recognize that if we understand what's being said today, we can't just sit back and say, yeah, it's a good idea. I think you're right. We have to be organized. We have to make the break. We have to distinguish ourselves from the United States government and the United States system. We are at a serious crossroads in the history of this country and the world, and we can be part of the future in a real way. I want to thank everybody for coming out and say, all power to the people, black power to the African community. Uhuru.
And that was African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess speaking in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania on February 24th, 1990. Excellent presentation by Chairwoman Hess. And, you know, the work of the African People's Solidarity Committee continues to grow in Philadelphia and in other cities around the country, and it's based in reparations. It's based in material solidarity and returning the stolen resources of Africa to the African struggle, to African people, to the African liberation movement, which is leading the way to a liberated and free humanity and free world. In Philadelphia today, I just want to give a thank you and a greeting to those people who hosted and participated in a fundraiser that the African People's Solidarity Committee helped to organize that was took place today, this afternoon, at the Diana Yoga Studio on 2nd Street in Old City in Philadelphia. They had a, looks like a 2.5-hour yoga workshop, a Kundalini yoga fundraiser to benefit African-led sustainability programs of the All African People's Development and Empowerment Project, APDEP, which is a program of the Uhuru Movement. They had a speaker there, Dr. Michelle Strongfields, who had been to Sierra Leone, conducting a health project in Sierra Leone, and the yoga benefit is raising funds for a variety of programs of APDEP, including a farm irrigation project in Zimbabwe, programs in Sierra Leone, including clean water and health programs, as well as a collective fishing project in Alosha. So that was really, really want to give thanks and, give greeting to the people who participated in that and who conducted that. Also, if you are, and of course in Philadelphia, we can't neglect the Uhuru Furniture Store, that if you need furniture and you're in Philadelphia, or if you have furniture to donate, it's at 1220 Spruce Street in Philadelphia, and you get the best furniture there, and all the proceeds goes to the Uhuru Movement. So that is an ongoing institution that the African People's Solidarity Committee participates in, volunteers in, encourages people to support. Also want to let people know one of the other projects that we do as a fundraiser around this time of year is the famous Uhuru Holiday Pies in both the Northern California area and in the St. Petersburg, Tampa Bay, Florida area. In Oakland, California, and basically we bake pies in the week prior to Thanksgiving and the week prior to Christmas. And you know what? It gives you an opportunity, people who buy pies, and they might be attending a family gathering or get together at work, and they can, on Thanksgiving, for example, they can take that pie in there, and it kind of opens the door, given that this pie raises funds for the Uhuru Movement and for the liberation struggle of African people, which also stands in firm solidarity with the liberation of and the return of the land of the indigenous people of North America, that when we think about the Thanksgiving holiday, and I know that Nyabinga Zimbabwe, hosting the Africa Live program earlier today on Uhuru Radio, spoke to this in more depth, but the Thanksgiving holiday, you know, is celebrated around America as a Thanksgiving for thanking the indigenous people for helping out the European settlers and keeping them from starving, which they would have done, I understand, without the assistance of the indigenous people who graciously told them what foods to eat and what foods to grow and how to prepare the foods of this land and, you know, offered them a welcome, and in return, the European settlers, the ancestors of white people in America today, slaughtered them, wiped them out, took their land, viciously and violently and brutally destroyed them, as Chairwoman Penny Hess described in her presentation. So, you know, when we go to these get-togethers, it's really, we feel important, if we can, to be able to tell the truth about what the holiday is about what America is about. And at the same time as we're sharing a meal with our family to be able to support the programs and the strategy of colonized and oppressed African people to put an end to oppressive, violent system of America. And so we bake and sell holiday pies, and it's a terrific fundraiser for the Uhuru Movement. So if you are in the Northern California area, if you haven't already ordered your pie and you want to either order your pie or go and pick up a pie at one of the various pie tables that are set up around the area, looks like there's a small army of volunteers out baking and selling pies in Northern California on this Tuesday. Well, today at the Grand Avenue Safeway store directly across the street from the Oakland Uhuru Furniture store on Grand Avenue in Oakland near Lake Merritt. there's Pie Sellers Out. And then on Tuesday, also in Oakland at the Safeway stores, both on College Avenue and Grand Avenue, you can get your pies. And also in Santa Cruz at Shopper's Corner. And then on Wednesday in the Oakland, California area, you can in Oakland, you can go to the Safeway stores at College Avenue and Grand Avenue. In Albany, to the Safeway store at Solano Avenue. In Santa Cruz to Shopper's Corner. And in Sebastopol to the Safeway at Main Street. And then in December, the same thing happens again. And, of course, they always need volunteers helping to bake, both in Oakland, California, and in St. Petersburg. And you can go to uhurupies.org on the web to find out more about that. In the St. Petersburg, Tampa area, if you are looking for pies on the day before Thanksgiving, you can go down to the Wednesday Midday Market in Williams Park, downtown St. Pete. And that's a lunchtime market, it's an arts and crafts fair, and the African People's Solidarity Committee will have a table with pies at that location as well. So this comes to the end of our program for this week. Really appreciate you tuning in. Encourage you to check out uhurusolidarity.org and, of course, uhurunews.com. Tell your friends. You know, if you're not going to be at your computer, you can always listen online. I mean, you can always listen over your telephone. The phone numbers are at the website. But if you're in the U.S., you can call the number 515-489-1870 or 425-905-1825. I'm sorry, the first number ended in 1670. Anyway, it's all on the website, uhurunews.com, uhururadio.com. And you can tune in wherever you are listening over your telephone. It's Sunday. You probably got free minutes, so check it out. It sounds pretty good over the telephone. It's amazing. And this comes to the end of the broadcast day for Uhuru News, for Uhuru Radio. I want to thank you again for tuning in. I encourage you to subscribe to uhururadio.com. Be a paying subscriber and help support this radio station and get free access to the speeches of Chairman O'Malley. So we're going to close out again with the song from Fela, Colonial Mentality. That's what we're overturning here on uhururadio.com.